You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 216 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity, 8 Lectures, translated by Paul King. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 22nd of September 1922. In the previous lectures, I tried to describe in detail the connection between the physical and soul aspects of the human being with the spiritual powers of the cosmos. Today I should like to add to that picture by describing details from an historical perspective, connections of historical life with the spiritual worlds, in a similar way to how this was done for the physical and soul existence of the human being. In our materialistic age, the study of history is restricted to its external aspect. People simply try to describe what occurs in the physical sensory world, while giving no consideration to how the spiritual world plays into the historical actions of humanity. Our age is completely lacking in the possibility of looking at the connection between what people do during the course of history and the beings and powers that are behind human existence. Today we'll take a look at ancient times of human development, beginning with the ages which in my book titled Occult Science I have called the Ancient Indian and the Ancient Persian epochs. Naturally, there were many different things done by people in this age that we view as the subject of history. But we need to be clear that precisely in that age, the actions taking effect externally as history were facts that resulted least of all from people's consciousness. For as far as we know, it was precisely in those ancient times that people's consciousness was permeated and pervaded by a kind of dreamlike clairvoyance. Pictures appeared to people in their consciousness, and spiritual beings played into the content of these pictures, which stimulated people to act in certain ways. Now, in the age we are speaking about, the process of inhalation played an extraordinarily important role in human life. You will realize just from the fact that through yoga exercises, the breathing process in those times had become a conscious process, a process of perception, that breath played a great role in those ancient times, and principally inhalation more than exhalation. We are simply not aware in our present age that apart from the coarse substantiality we expect to find in the air when we inhale, there are all sorts of other substances there as well, but in an exceptionally subtle and rarefied form. The substances that in our present earthly existence we otherwise find in a solid mineral state are also distributed in a very rarefied way throughout the atmosphere, and people breathe these in. But these substances, in their highly rarefied distribution in the atmosphere, have the curious tendency to create forms. Certainly, matter in earthly substance also takes on form. We know these forms as mineral crystals. But these are not the crystals I mean at the moment. I mean those substances that are finely distributed in the atmosphere. We can also say in the etheric atmosphere, insofar as this permeates the air. These substances also create forms. But these forms are not like the forms of the minerals. Rather, they are similar to the forms of human organs. This is a peculiarity of the ether permeating the air. If we are able to observe this ether, how it permeates the air and how it can appear for imaginative cognition, we perceive in this ether subtle etheric forms flying around, as it were, which have the shape of a lung, the shape of the liver or stomach, at any rate the shapes of human inner organs. If we are trained in etheric perception, we can observe all human forms out there in the cosmic ether. But in comparison to our physical organs, these organ forms, as a rule, are of gigantic size. We see huge etheric liver forms, lung forms, pervading the space of the cosmos around us. What is flying around out there as forms, as it were, is what people breathe in. And it is good that they can do this, because by inhaling, these forms that enter us with the air work on our organs in a restorative, health-giving way. During the course of life, our organs deteriorate more and more. And in a certain sense, if I can express it somewhat crudely, they are, in quotes, patched up by what is inhaled. We know how difficult it is for therapies to patch up human organs. But the therapy meant here must actually work on people constantly, and indeed it does. Now, in those most ancient times of historical human development, people were able, without any particular training, by virtue of their dreamlike clairvoyance, to see these etheric forms and also their significance for the human being. They were able to see what it meant, let's say, when the human stomach form, which was dissolved in etheric pepsin-like substances, was breathed in and absorbed by the stomach. People were very aware of such things in ancient times, and the further back we go, the more aware people were of their relationship with the subtle aspects of their environment. But this process of etheric forms entering people when they inhaled was not simply automatic, was not simply a matter of people sucking air into themselves as though into an emptied airspace. It was not simply a matter of people breathing in. Because in this process, in this submersion, as it were, of cosmic forms into the human being, an activity of spiritual beings was involved. Let's assume that this is one of these forms, and there's a drawing. The person breathes in. The form dives down into the individual. But an activity of spiritual beings is involved here at the same time. In the lectures I gave recently, some public and some given here, we got to know spiritual beings of a particular kind and their significance for human beings. The beings meant here are those that have their physical image in the moon and its moonlight. They are the spiritual moon beings. In the times I have been speaking about, it was these spiritual moon beings who were able to shape their way from the outer cosmic circle into the human being by means of these forms. So in their process of inhalation, in those ancient times of human development on Earth, people breathed the spiritual moon cosmos into themselves and stimulated the moon beings to a particular activity in themselves. What I have just related was the content of a science and wisdom much studied in the most ancient mystery schools of humanity. For the initiates of these mystery schools knew that human beings were subject to these processes, that they drew the spiritual moon cosmos into themselves. But they also knew that this drawing in took place predominantly at night, when people were asleep. But because all people in primal times had a dreamlike clairvoyance, an intermediary state between waking and sleeping, one could count on these spiritual moon beings being drawn into people also during certain times of the day. And the whole guidance the initiates of the ancient mysteries carried out for humanity relied on controlling what these moon beings brought into human beings by way of the process of inhalation. This enabled people to utilize in their own activity the forces of these moon beings who had made their way into human beings by this path. You need to realize that today's intellectual mode of teaching did not exist in those ancient times. Nevertheless, The initiates had ways and means of guiding and leading the populace in a far more intensive way than was the case later on, or indeed is the case today. For example, in the most ancient times of human development, the skill was most definitely developed in the mysteries of speaking with the moon beings that were breathed in by people during the night and during the active intermediary periods of clairvoyance in the day. The initiates spoke to these beings in the mysteries and stimulated them to bring very specific things into humanity. This was the magnificent means by which the initiates of the ancient mysteries were able to lead the people, and whereby the moon beings were their helpers via the process of inhalation. Humanity today has very inadequate ideas about the particular and extraordinarily mysterious processes that were outwardly reflected in all manner of rituals and ceremonies performed in ancient times in order for the mystery centers to lead humanity. But a different age arose with humanity's advancing development. The old clairvoyance faded away more and more, so that those special procedures that could be performed by the initiates of the original Indian and original Persian periods, as I have just described, became increasingly difficult. To be sure, in certain regions, remnants of the old clairvoyance lasted up to the mystery of Golgotha and even a few centuries beyond. But it was very dim, and already in the third and second millennia before the mystery of Golgotha, the procedures I have just described were no longer performed with the same intensity as in the very ancient times of human development, immediately after the age of Atlantis. We could say that the initiates of the mysteries found themselves increasingly at a loss when they wanted to use the force of the moon beings in order to lead humanity. To explain what was going on between the initiates of the mysteries and the moon beings that were used in ancient times, in the procedures I have described, I should like to express it like this. When, for example, an initiate, already of the Egypto-Chaldean period, approached a moon being and wanted to give him a task that involved the moon beings entering the human being through inhalation and imprinting certain things into the human soul, the moon being responded, as it were, by saying to the initiate, quote, "During the day we no longer have shelter on earth. We can only find shelter during the night," close quote. But it would have seemed highly dubious to the initiate to work on people via the moon beings during the night, because this would be treating people in an automatic way, as it were. Something would have come about which, to use a certain terminology, one would definitely call black magic. The good initiates naturally kept far away from this. So it was of tremendous significance for them when the moon beings, who were supposed to be their helpers in their guidance of humanity, answered them by saying, quote, "During the day we have no shelter on earth," close quote. Thus the initiates of these mysteries faced the danger of having no helpers on the paths they had used for guiding humanity. What came later, on the other hand, through the mystery of Golgotha, had also not yet arrived. Thus there was an intermediary period between the very ancient age of clairvoyance, in which everything I have described could take place, and the age ushered in by the mystery of Golgotha, when all working of the spirit on earth was changed. We can study this intermediary period most particularly in the culture of ancient Egypt. Egyptian development followed on from the ancient Persian period. The initiates of Chaldean humanity did not know what to do with respect to the question I have just mentioned. In a certain sense, they were completely baffled by it, and consequently took a rather external route to look for what they needed to guide humanity. They turned to their star wisdom, to their art of interpreting the stars. What the Chaldean initiates learned through their astrology was what, in those more ancient times, could be learned through the moon beings who entered people via inhalation. Now, however, these beings said they could find no shelter on the earth, and so people substituted the force that was previously given inwardly, as it were, with the force of external observation. The initiates of the Egyptian world sought to deal with the problem in a completely different way. The Egyptian initiates looked for ways and means to provide the moon beings with shelter on the earth. So the Egyptian initiates now tried to create this shelter for the beings who, according to the primal and eternal laws of world evolution, were no longer destined to have shelter on earth. And it was precisely the mystery priests of Egypt who found a means of providing shelter for the moon beings of Luciferic form. This puzzle of how to get the moon spirits to descend once more to earth, even though according to the eternal evolution of the world, they were no longer destined to do so, was solved by the Egyptian priests by populating their burial sites with mummies. I have mentioned this in previous lectures from another perspective. I would like to mention it today from this cosmic historical perspective. The mummified corpse of the human being became the shelter for the luciferically configured moon gods. In ancient times, something could be observed in a natural way, by simply coming together with people and clairvoyantly observing their breathing. This no longer took place in these natural processes. But through the old inhalation, it had swarmed around, as it were, in societal life and played a role in humanity. This was now substituted in the sites where the spirits that found no shelter in humanity during the day, spirits that would have had to wander the earth without shelter and could not have been used for the events of earthly history, were accommodated, as it were, in mummified human bodies. Mummies were the habitation of the moon beings. And when an Egyptian initiate stood with full understanding before a mummy, he studied by means of this mummy what had previously been studied outside in the freshness of life. He observed what the moon gods were carrying out in these habitations provided for them. And in this way, the initiates became aware of what they could inculcate into human historical development in the most manifold ways. As paradoxical as it may seem to the materialistically minded person of today, it is nevertheless true that if we want to understand what took place historically in the development of the Egyptian cultural epoch, there is no other way than by studying not merely the external historical monuments, but by studying the eternal cosmic chronicle through imaginative and inspirative sight, what is to be read there about the activity of the spiritual moon entities for whom no external monuments have been erected, and who have left behind no historical documents. But the actions of the people who did erect external monuments was inspired by the spiritual moon beings via an indirect route. It was inspired through the work of initiates with the moon beings, once shelter had been provided for these beings in mummies during daytime on earth. And we only learn to recognize properly the origin of what is to be found in the written documents if we can find the beings in the cosmic chronicle that say to us, during the period of the 3rd, 2nd, 1st pre-Christian millennia, we could only inhabit the earth because the Egyptian initiates gave us earthly habitations in mummies. We can learn from these moon beings the source of the intentions behind the historical actions of that time. If we wish to know man in his true being, we must go to the stars and the hierarchies, as I discussed in the previous two lectures. But if we wish to know humanity's historical development in the right way, we have to be able to study the spiritual powers that play into this historical development. Thus, we have to be prepared to study the significance of such a striking phenomenon as mummification in ancient Egypt. When we are really able to do research using spiritual science, we learn to see the inner meaning of things, which for people with today's materialistic perceptions appear merely as a strange custom. Mummies were once habitations of gods. Moon beings that had become luciferic had their habitation in mummies. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, in the Greek and Roman period, things became somewhat different. The dominance of inhalation ceased. Inhalation was still significant, but its dominant quality came to an end. And inhalation and exhalation became processes of equal importance for humanity. This is something to which the Greek initiates paid special attention in their work. And that wonderful state of balance between inhalation and exhalation, which was a special feature of the Greeks, enabled Greek art in its exemplary nature to emerge in history in the way it did. The Greeks were not particularly predisposed to absorb the moon beings by inhalation. Through their initiates, what was typical of the Greeks was to bring into operation those beings that developed a quality of half flying, half swimming in the air, and that liked most to rock themselves in the state of balance between inhalation and exhalation. And when we go back into those ancient times of Greek development, when the actual inspiration for what was to emerge later in a more external form was first given, when we go back to the times that give us the origins of the sublime primitive forms from which Greek sculpture, Greek tragedy, and Greek philosophy emerged, we find that the initiates in particular of the Greek mysteries were gifted most especially in using those beings for their guidance of humanity that rocked themselves gently in the balance brought about between human inhalation and exhalation. And fundamentally speaking, we cannot learn the art of Apollo and the Orphic wisdom without recognizing that each of these received their special soul quality because their helpers were elemental, demonic beings that moved on this equilibrium of inhalation and exhalation. The tuning of the strings of Apollo's lyre was derived from what one could observe when the beings danced upon the balance between human in-breath and out-breath, between the moon sphere and the earth sphere, danced, we could say, on the strings of the cosmos that were woven in equilibrium through inhalation and exhalation. What was imitated in the tuning of the strings on the lyre of Apollo and other similar things were the dances of the air demons. If we wish to ascertain what happened historically in the external world, we have to look into the spiritual world. Recall what I said here not so long ago, that chanting, the development of recitative, the development of the hexameter, is based on the ratio in our rhythmic aspect between the rhythm of respiration and the rhythm of blood circulation. Recall what I discussed in this regard in the course given over in the other building relating to the structure of the hexameter. The study required to discover the hexameter was once a very concrete study for Greek initiates. When we breathe in, we take in the vibrations of the cosmos and adapt them to our inner being. When we breathe out, we impart to our breath rhythm something of the vibrating pulse in our blood circulation. Thus we can say that in our inhalation the outer world pulsates into us, and in our exhalation the pulsing of our own blood lives outward. Thus the Greek initiates who were trained in this matter could observe around people, in their etheric and astral bodies, how cosmic rhythm and pulse rhythm met, how they wafted and mingled together, and how upon these rhythms the air demons rocked themselves and carried out their dances. This is the study Homer was called upon to undertake when he developed the hexameter to its full blossoming, for it is born out of the relationship of the human being to the cosmos. Many historical things only become clear when we look at them with the eye, E-Y-E, of one who understands art with a discerning artistic eye. I will not go into the fact that the materialistic thinking of our time, instead of actually pondering the special way in which the Homeric verses came about, assists itself by saying that a Homer did not exist at all. That is by far the simplest thing to do from the standpoint of the current materialistic mindset. Comprehending Homer is something that is impossible for materialistic knowledge. And what one cannot comprehend is not permitted to exist, according to the way of thinking that in our time has become so proud and vain. What cannot be understood by the academic intellect ought not to exist and doesn't exist. People can't understand Homer, so, therefore, there was no Homer. But maybe something else would be better. In museums everywhere, we can still find sculptures of the head of Homer. Now, I'm not saying that this Homer head is particularly good, but it is good enough that when we look at this Homer, who is portrayed as blind, and who, despite his blindness, has a very special expression in his eyes and holds his head in a curious way, when we enter into this position of the head, we get the feeling that he was blinded voluntarily, I'm speaking figuratively, so that seeing would not disturb him in a profound listening. He listens to what he perceives in the pulses vibrating together in the pulse of the cosmos and the pulse of human blood, of the human etheric body, and on which the air beings perform their harmonious and melodious dances. What he hears there is a different kind of whirring sound, like when we listen to the whirring of a swarm of gnats, where there is a whirring of the hexameter. What he hears is this whirring, while he is undisturbed by sight or ordinary bright daylight, condenses for him in such a way that his ears also become organs of touch, as it were. Look at a sculpted head of Homer with this in mind. There is a touching hearing, a hearing touching. There is a very special kind of life that moves through this plaster or marble form. Something is partially released in this head nature that flashes from inside through the blind eyes, something that doesn't only hear but touches the tones and takes hold of the tactile tone in order to transpose it into the chanting organ of the voice, something that was taken into the human being from the cosmos at a time when neither inhalation on the one hand nor exhalation on the other predominated, but when an intermingled sounding of both existed, the in-breath and the out-breath. The question that someone looking at the head of Homer should be most curious to ask is, how does he breathe? This head is completely undistracted by external light. It is fully devoted to the mysteries of the breath. This feeling about the Homer sculpture, which can be seen everywhere, would make more sense than trying to argue ancient Homer away. The arguments for dismissing Homer were so tempting and beguiling that even Goethe did not deal with them fully. The first person during Goethe's time to argue Homer away, to say that Homer had not existed at all, was the German philologist Wolff. But even Goethe could not escape the tempting and alluring arguments of this philologist. And although he always felt a horror at the idea that Wolf had devoured Homer, on the other hand, he was also partly confounded by the immensely clever arguments that were propounded. Just look at all the things modern cleverness can do. People have really become extraordinarily clever, but being clever doesn't necessarily mean knowing anything about the world. Hermann Grimm later attempted, not to bring Homer back to life, to be sure, since Wolf had not devoured Homer, but only a perception of Homer that had emerged over time. Hermann Grimm later attempted the following. He said, "Let us not concern ourselves initially about Homer. Let us not concern ourselves about Wolf, who has devoured him. But look at Homer's title Iliad itself. Let us try to read this Homeric epic, not in the way a philologist reads it, but how an ordinary person reads it. Let us take Book One and see what artistic quality was used in composing it. Then let us look at how it continues, how it develops. Let us go to the next book, to Book Two. Curious, we find again and again how each book is developed with an inner composition, as though with a wonderful artistic feeling that is similar to the previous book." Taking this approach, Hermann Grimm goes through the whole Iliad, and he says if Homer never existed, it would be highly curious if over the course of time first one portion of the Iliad, then a second, then a third were composed, and then all collected together. In this way, philologists might come to the view that Faust was also composed like this, because one could find inconsistencies in it. At any rate, it would be a very strange circumstance if such an inwardly coherent composition as the Iliad had been put together from all sorts of fragments from different places. It is necessary to go so deeply into history that we bear in mind the weaving and working of spiritual beings into the direct processes of history. This is something anthroposophical spiritual science must also endeavor to do. And I've tried to analyze this for you today with regard initially to more ancient times up to Greek culture. Tomorrow we will see how, in our present history, since the mystery of Golgotha, these spiritual beings still show themselves to be active in human actions, although these actions are becoming freer and freer. And we will see how to find what we ourselves need to do, whether perhaps we need to help ourselves much as the Egyptian initiates did when they provided shelter for certain moon beings. Perhaps our own times require, based on a proper spirit knowledge, that something similar must gain ground. The end of Lecture 3.